And one of the things that we've noticed about the imagination, I think, is how all-encompassing it is, particularly, both of the lectures last night when Dick spoke and when Sarah was speaking to us this morning. I've been struck by how much of what we think of as being distinct about humanness is connected to the imagination. It's hard to conceive of what being a human even is if we subtract the use of our imaginations from everyday life. So it's a capacity we employ constantly. It's through the imagination that we can think about anything that is not immediately available to our senses. That's sort of what Dick's image last night of, if you can think about the front of the house that you just walked in a while ago, then you have an imagination because you're not looking at the front of the house now. You're referring to an image that's in your mind. So basically anything that is not present in the little sliver of space and time that we occupy. The only way we access any of that is through our imagination. So how often do you think about things that are not currently, that you're not currently touching, tasting, feeling, seeing, and hearing? A lot. That's probably most of what occupies our minds most days, things that we're not actually physically present to but are still in our minds. As Sarah mentioned earlier, one of my takeaway points for this weekend is that the imagination is like a compost pile, something that we're feeding with all kinds of things. We can feed it with the wrong things, maybe, but something that we feed and we turn it over, and the result, if we're doing it well, is great fertility, really. And I don't want to chase that analogy too far, but there you go. Run with that if you will. We'll change the subject. The imagination is immensely powerful, but morally uncommitted. And that's another thing that we were learning from last night, I think, particularly. It doesn't, in and of itself, take a moral stance. So it can take us in very bad directions and in very good directions. It's with our imaginations that we lust, that we covet, that we murder someone else in our hearts, that we chase after false gods and place our hopes on things that are no hope. And it's through our imaginations that we long to be like the wrong people sometimes. But it's also with our imaginations that we hunger and thirst for righteousness, that we long to see God, that we envision the work, that we envision and work for the coming of His kingdom. Some picture of what the coming kingdom might look like is actually one of the most powerful motivators for living the Christian life. What would it look like if God's kingdom came? It's through our imaginations that we love other people who are not easy to love. One of the things I was thinking about last night when Dick was speaking, think how often love has to do with seeing the potential in another person. A really good teacher with difficult students very often can see the potential in someone that doesn't even necessarily see that potential themselves. But it has to do with envisioning a future for somebody. And that's really important part of what it is to love somebody. I'm going to dig around through this book that I forgot to get out. But what came to my mind was a little snippet from the very end of C.S. Lewis's Weight of Glory. And he's talking about, it made me think, this loving somebody by having a vision of their future potential. And he says, "It may be possible for each to think too much of his own potential glory hereafter. It is hardly possible for him to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare." So think of how much of what he's saying there has to do with our imagination, our envisioning these two potential, completely opposite futures for every person we meet. And really valuing each person as an image of God that one day will potentially be a glory. But we don't see much of that right now. That's a hard reality to believe without very, very active and baptized imaginations, as Sarah was talking about today. So, but to wrap up the day, I thought we'd talk about art, because art is one of, I think, the most profound ways in which we employ our imaginations, both in producing art and in appreciating art. So the imagination is essential to both. We conceive art, the artist conceives art, and the audience perceives art. Both are an act of the imagination, so that the imagination is sort of a connecting bridge between an artist and the audience. An artist uses their imagination to make art, but also relies on the imagination of their audience to connect with what they've made. No work of art could ever have an impact if it were not for the imagination of the people looking at it or listening to it. And I'm going to be talking about art in a very general sense here. I'm aware that is some of the things I'll be saying will apply more to some kinds of art than others. I'm speaking in a lot of generalizations today, and so we'll just have to roll with that if we can, and then maybe talk about more specifics in the discussion time. But I'm not really talking just to artists. I'm talking to anybody who's open to engaging with art. Which is probably, if you've shown up, you're probably at least mildly interested in engaging with art. It's a self-selecting crowd, so that's good. I myself am nowhere near as informed as I should be about trends in contemporary art. This is my disclaimer. Nor equally well informed about all genres of art. I have more experience thinking about songwriting than anything else. That's been something I've tried to do for a long time. Film, poetry, sculpture, drama, not an expert in any of these, although I try to be an appreciator. But I'll offer some thoughts anyway, and I'm really glad that there's quite a few people in the room who are artists and have something maybe more specific and informed to say. So because the imagination could lead us closer to God and further away from Him, depending on where it takes us, art has the potential to move us in either direction as well. I'm speaking mostly about the imagination as a good and healthy way in which we engage with art. But in the back of our minds, I think we just have to keep in mind that the imagination also can lead us in really destructive places. But most of what I'm saying today is referring to the imagination in a positive light, something we need. The main thing I want to reflect on today, with your help, is thinking about the imagination as something that needs room. It's something that cannot function powerfully if it has no room to move. And so there's whatever metaphor you want to use, but if you think of it as a flame, it's something that can be smothered. We've talked about that a little bit already in our discussion today. If we think of it as a wild animal, it can be put in too small a cage. So some enclosure might be necessary for both a fire and a wild animal, but if either are too restricted, they will suffer and die, or not thrive. So this lecture is about leaving room for the imagination. I think it's a thing that needs room. And it's one of the ways that art actually leaves room for the imagination is through ambiguity. So that's what I want to talk about today. That's where I'm headed. And my outline today is just to talk a little bit about what do I mean by ambiguity, and maybe I'll just leave it at that, shall I? And then the strength or potential strength of ambiguity, and then resistance to ambiguity that we see both in the culture at large, but also specifically among Christians. So what do I mean by ambiguity, first of all? You can look up a definition for yourself, but basically doubtfulness or uncertainty of meaning or intention. So to be ambiguous is to avoid explicit clarity. So in other words, when someone communicates to us in an ambiguous way, we're unsure exactly what they mean, at least at first we are, and we're unsure of their intentions for saying what they said. Our associations with the word are not always positive. I think what comes to your mind when you hear ambiguity? I don't know. Anything?
It's a trap.
It's a trap. Don't go in that door. I've got a bad feeling about this. Something's missing. It's a lack.
Say what you really
need. Yeah. Just spit it out. Be honest. I think we have negative connotations with the word, particularly when we think of the reasons why someone is speaking ambiguously to us. It can be confusion, I think. If someone's a verbal processor, they don't know quite what they mean yet, and so they'll speak, and the result is ambiguity, because, they're still working through it themselves. I think that's very common. I'm guilty of that sometimes. It can be self-protection. Someone is afraid of what might happen if they speak more openly, so they're ambiguous. It can also be outright deception. So ambiguity can be a way of intentionally dissembling, trying to complicate and confuse what otherwise might be the straightforward truth or something uncomfortable to talk about. So whatever the motivation, to be ambiguous is to avoid communicating in any one distinct way. And you might say, well, that's right, so isn't it just bad? And I would say sometimes yes. When straightforward clarity is what's called for. But there are other reasons for ambiguity that actually have real communication and not deception in mind, and that's what I want to talk about today. It can sometimes be used not to obscure meaning, but to better communicate difficult and complex meaning. And when it comes to art, I'm using the word ambiguity very loosely. There may be better words to use in different cases, but ambiguous art resists easy or quick interpretations. It's not immediately obvious what is meant. There may be layers of meaning to a painting or to a film or to a work of drama. It's a quality in art that leaves us with questions and prompts us to keep on thinking about the piece, whatever it is. It can be an arresting quality, something that grabs hold of us and won't let go of us, when a piece intrigues us and disturbs us at the same time. Some of the best art, I think, grabs us, appeals to us, and also troubles us at once. And that's a way of perceiving ambiguity. You're not sure exactly where you stand. If we're to get anything out of it at all, it will demand a deep and not a superficial engagement. So that's one of the things about ambiguous art. Sometimes we look at a piece of art we don't understand, or we listen to something, or we see a play, and we don't really know what we think about it. We have a choice to just say, that one wasn't for me, I guess, or engage with it more deeply and find out what's going on, or try to understand what's going on a deeper level. So, I'm just going to show an image. Hopefully this will show up. This is of a little bit hard to see, but and I'll show you different, the image oriented differently. I've seen this drawing flipped around and on every possible angle, even hanging on the wall in different orientations. So it's something that could be viewed from different angles. It's a piece called Carry Me by an artist named Tim Lowy, made in 2002. There's about a million different things one could show during this. This is almost sort of an arbitrary choice that I found in a book and I thought was really interesting. So it is a portrait of the artist's severely disabled daughter being held by six women. And I'll show you. You can see the faces of the women better when you look at it from different angles. This is the other side. So what are these women doing with this girl? What's going on? My immediate question is, who are they looking at? Are they looking at you, the viewer? Is this a challenge to you? If so, why, and what's the challenge? They're looking up. It's very clearly vertically oriented. They're looking up. Are they looking at God? Do their expressions betray anything on their faces? What's the attitude or what's their attitude towards whoever they're looking at you or God or whoever. What? A couple of things come to my mind. Has anyone ever had to play one of those trust games where you stand on a table and fall back and people catch you? This is sort of a group bonding experience. And it's either positive or negative for us, depending on our depending how trustworthy our friends were, I guess. But that's an interesting line of thinking here, because this is a person that can't even stand on her own. She's wheelchair bound. Who, whether she likes it or not, has to trust people to do things for her. Another thing that comes into my mind immediately is the friends who carry the paralytic to see Jesus. Particularly the title of the piece, "Carry Me." They seem to be offering her up, right? And to me, there seems like there's a note of challenge in some of their expressions. Like, what are you going to do about this? What are you going to make of this person? Or what are you going to make of a world in which a person can be this broken physically? These are just things that come to my mind, but it's not exactly clear what the artist is up to. It's not spelled out in a caption or a moral, or it doesn't have any accompanying essay that goes with it. Should it be absolutely clear, or is it okay? Is total clarity what's called for or not? We'll be talking about, on the one hand, art that leaves something to the imagination, art that expects our imaginations to do some work, some heavy lifting, and then on the other hand, art that leaves nothing or very little to the imagination, which is sort of a restriction or a narrowed scope of the possibility for imagination. And I just want to say at the very outset that the most extreme form of art that leaves no room for imagination, it has a name, and it's called propaganda. Propaganda is art that in which there's only one possible and obvious meaning, and very often one obvious call to action or action point for you. There's no ambiguity whatsoever. In fact, one of the technical definitions of propaganda is disambiguation, which means there's nothing ambiguous at all about this. You look at the poster, whatever it is, buy war bonds, or, you know, I want you for the United States Army, or whatever it is, vote for Bernie Sanders, not anymore, I guess. It's clear what's expected. Well, it's clear what the poster wants you to think. It's not ambiguous. So what do I mean by the strength of ambiguity? And I'm talking here first about what I'm trying to get at is what does it mean to make room for the imagination? Ambiguity in art is often a very powerful thing because it leaves the audience work to do, as I was saying. The viewer has to employ their imagination to enter in to the world that the artist has constructed. Entering in is the operative phrase there. Are we entering into something or are we not? It's not that the piece is necessarily incomplete, and it's not that there's no meaning in it at all. Rather, the meaning is something that must be arrived at over some time, maybe, or through a process by the listener or the viewer or whatever the piece happens to be. In a strange way, I think it's analogous to hospitality. One of our last theme weekends, we talked about hospitality for a couple of days and all the different aspects of it. But hospitality, if you stay with some friends for a week, if you go to their house, and they give you a nice warm bed and food to eat three times a day, but they never let you do anything to help at all. They never let you lift a finger. That might be really nice, actually, for the first few days. But after a while, you realize that you would actually feel a little bit more at home, not less at home, if they let you peel the carrots or dry the dishes. You're still on the outside of some boundary marker when you are not allowed to help, right? Maybe this is just, I don't know if anyone feels the same way. But it's a different kind of space being made for you when you're expected to participate in the life of a home. Not just passively receive. So you're not just being entertained anymore. Instead, you're closer to being a part of a household. And this is not a perfect analogy at all, but there's something like this can take place when we approach a work of art. I feel that I am more a part of what the artist is doing if I'm allowed to make some connections myself if I'm allowed to look for the meaning in it, if I have to even maybe struggle a bit. Art that does this well actually welcomes us in an odd way. Not by telling us what to think, but by allowing us to push on the door a little bit. If you push on the door and you gain understanding, you feel like you belong there. Now, I know that this sounds ironic, because very often when we go to the art museum and we stand, maybe we're in the contemporary wing of the art museum and we're looking at something that's incomprehensible to us, we don't feel like we're being welcomed in. We may feel alienated in every way from this piece, but, and it may be an alienating piece, who knows, but my point is that a lot will depend on what our attitude towards it is. Are we willing to engage it and seek for understanding when we don't understand? If we are, there's this potential of entering into something much bigger that can stretch us in a good way. It's a little bit like this. So when someone has to explain a joke to you after telling it, the joke might have been funny itself, but the explanation is never funny. Because a large part of what makes a joke enjoyable to us is that we, the listeners, are allowed to make the connection, right? A punchline wouldn't be a punchline if it was explained to you as it was given. The twist in a punchline is very often what we arrive at ourselves, right? And that's what makes a room erupt in laughter. If someone has to explain the joke to you, it's just not funny. It may be helpful, and it may allow you to get why everybody else was laughing, or it may help you to tell the joke yourself later on, but it doesn't replace the joke. The explanation never replaces the joke. It can't. And this is the same with a lot of art. A detailed explanation of exactly what is meant does not replace the thing itself, and it can't. One of the things, this is something that Dick has often talked about in language, that in language there's very often almost a seesaw kind of effect, where you can use words with great power and less precision, or you can use words with great precision and less power. And that's an interesting thing to think about when we communicate to each other. How much precision are we using, how much power, and when is it appropriate to use more of one than the other? But precision and power, there's a world of difference between a legal document and a poem. Both written in the English language, both communicating something. But a legal document is precise. It has to be precise. It uses lots and lots and lots of words to achieve as much clarity as possible, or to anticipate every possible misunderstanding or abuse of the words. It is precise, but it lacks power. It's like the analogy Dick was using last night. You're working on your taxes and you can't stay awake, but you sit down and pick up a novel and suddenly you perk up. Right? There's something about the power of something versus the precision. My imagination has never been captured by a legal document. I don't read them often, but I've never felt that through my imagination I'm entering into a legal document. But a poem is very, very different. A poem can be powerful, but it is not as precise. We're not precise in the same way. It uses many less words, but relies on the impact of the imagery on the minds of the readers. So a tremendous weight is resting on very few words, and on the imagination of the reader to run with those images and to make something of them and maybe apply something of their own life and experience to those very few words, and to connect with something that the poet is trying to get at. The result, one of the results, is that a poem can be read in different ways. Different people can pick up on different aspects of a poem. I can think the point of this poem is this, and someone else can think the point is something else. A poem is much more open to interpretations and even misunderstandings than a legal document. Even legal documents have to be interpreted, but in a much different way than a poem. Anyone who loves poetry is glad that it communicates in a different way than a legal document. It speaks in its own way. It speaks with a power, not with the same kind of precision, but with a power, and that's a good thing. Daniel Levitin is an interesting guy. He's a music producer who became a neuroscientist. He's written a number of best-selling books, including This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs. And there's a quote, interesting quote. He says a lot of troubling things I don't really like, but knows a lot about the brain and a lot about music. And this is a comment that he made in his book, The World in Six Songs. He says, "One characteristic of poetry and lyrics compared to ordinary speech or writing is compression of meaning. Meaning tends to be densely packed, conveyed in fewer words than we would use in conversation or prose. The compression of meaning invites us to interpret, to be participants in the unfolding of the story. The best poetry, the best art in any medium, is ambiguous. Ambiguity begets participation." Something like what I'm trying to say, getting at it. There is a potential power in the ambiguity of art, the power to draw people in, but because their imaginations are given room to move, there's no telling what direction they may head in, right? I think an example of this in a lot of work, particularly maybe in work involving words, I think of it as in songwriting, is the power of understatement. So when what is left unsaid actually speaks the loudest, what's implied actually carries the most weight. And this is because only the audience can make the connections. This is similar to the joke, remember. They've been invited to form an image of an untold story behind the one being told. And so just one example is there's this singer named Gillian Welch, who I really love a lot of her songs. She sings a song about being abandoned by her parents and adopted into a new family. It's one of her autobiographical songs. She was adopted as a baby. She has never known any blood relative. She doesn't even know if she has sisters or brothers. And she feels as if she has never even really known her name. Is it just something that she talks about in the song, or she sings in the song? So this is the context. And in the very last verse, she says this really interesting line, which I think to me has been an example of understatement and the power that can be held in understatement. She says, "Now and then there's a lonesome feeling on my mind. Now and then there's a lonesome feeling on my mind. On a crowded street I see a stranger's face that looks like me." And then she goes on. But there is so much in that statement that if we take the time to reflect on it, we see exactly what she's saying. But she's not telling us, "Wow, you know, when I see someone that looks like me on the street, I wonder, oh my gosh, could that be a relative? I don't know." But, you know, she's not explaining it. She just lays it out. And she kind of trusts the song to carry the meaning. And really, the reason why it's powerful is because if we're attending, we enter in. We participate in what she's doing. One of the things that ambiguity can do is also, I call this productively destabilizing. It can productively destabilize us. And that may sound like a total contradiction, but ambiguity can be troubling to us because we do not know where to stand. Or we do not know what we should feel. But this is sometimes exactly where we need to be. I'm picking a really old example here. I think it might have been recorded even before I was born. It's a song called "Sail Away" by Randy Newman. Does anyone know this song? Randy Newman? It's the title track of his third album. I was going to try to play it on the big speakers, but we've had all kinds of technical issues. Okay. And you can crank it way up. Just a word. See, I'm for the sake of the lecture, because we're talking about this, I'm going to give one brief line of explanation, even though that's what I'm saying we shouldn't be doing, but whatever. The voice in the song, it's not immediately obvious who's talking and why, but the voice is that of a slave trader trying to convince an African to climb on board the ship and come to America. That's what's happening in the song. So the premise is already horrific, right? Just get ready. let's listen to the song. Oh, sorry. Can you advance it to the very beginning, Adam? Is that all right? In America, you get food deep. Won't have to run through the jump and scuffle. You just sing about Jesus and drink wine all day. Sail Away by Randy Newman, trying to sell America to a slave, potential slave. To me, I mean, this is a song that takes a lot of thinking about to know how to respond to this song, because it's so horrific, and I still get angry every time I listen to the song, actually. I did just now, even. not at Randy Newman, but... At the insight I think we get about slavery through what Randy Newman is saying.
Ben.
Yeah.
Was it not the case that nobody really enticed people to come to Africa from Africa to the United States?
I think in many cases that's true. It's not. He's not claiming to be historical here.
So, in my understanding, what was going on was there were tribal wars in Africa, and the losers were sold by the winners into slavery.
Yeah, I don't want to get too on a tangent about this because he's not attempting to be precisely historical about this. This is what the kind of thing that happened necessarily. I think it's true what you're saying.
So here we have an example of very powerful emotional words being imprecise. And conveying information which is not correct information.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. But are you looking for? It depends whether we're talking about actual, historically factual information or something that's true that we need to think about. But
it's,
right. I'm going to continue, and then we can talk about this later.
Yeah.
Just because I don't want to get too sidetracked.
Okay. A rabbit trail. Never mind.
Yeah. We can totally go there in the discussion if you want, but. So if you think about the voice of this person, slave trader, he's telling horrible lies, right? This is something that we notice immediately. Particularly the part of the song that nails me the most is every man is free to take care of his home and his family, right? This is just one of this is precisely one of the most horrific things about slavery, which is that actually nobody could take care of their family. Families were intentionally broken apart, and children sold down the river and whatever. The slave trader tempts this person with the very stereotypes that await them in the New World. Newman, he's been interviewed about this song, and he says this: it's like a recruiter out there in the jungle recruiting for the slave trade with basketballs and watermelons and all kinds of offensive stuff. So he's trying to get people to come to America anticipating all the things that they will then be stereotyped as. And, you know, think about Jesus, drink wine, eat watermelon, and buckwheat cakes, and whatever. These sort of images. So this is actually Randy Newman's attempt to examine the great sin of America. And it makes us deeply uncomfortable, or at least it should. Why did he choose to write a song like this? Someone had written him an assignment. Say, Randy Newman, write a song reflecting on slavery. Why did he do this? he obviously made some choices there. He says, I wrote Sail Away because the slave trade is our main imperialist crime, our insoluble problem. One of the most troubling aspects of this song, I think, and many of his songs, is this juxtaposition between the music and the words. And he's a master of this. The result is deeply ambiguous to me. The music is sweet and consonant and without much tension at all. Particularly his string parts, his big orchestral string parts, sometimes bordering on the sentimental almost. Very conventional, big, rich harmonies, cinematic. He's written a lot of music for the movies. So that's the setting. But then the lyrics are jarring and shocking and disturbing and thorny. And his vocal performance displays zero sentimentality. He's almost mumbling the whole time. No emotion at all. He just... he was interviewed on NPR by Bob Edwards. Bob Edwards asked him, basically, you know, why do you compose such a beautiful song about such a horrible subject? And his reply was, well, what am I supposed to say? Slavery is bad? It's like falling out of an airplane and hitting the ground. It's just too easy, and it has no effect. So, interesting point. The question is, does this have an effect? it's not nicely resolved. He doesn't tell us what he really means. He's just made us uncomfortable. And I've often felt bad for even finding the music beautiful. but are portrayals of this part of our history supposed to make us comfortable? That's the question. No, of course not. Are we supposed to be comfortable even with our moral indignation about it? As if being indignant settles the matter or helps anything. I think Randy Newman knows that most of us are used to feeling bad about slavery. Most white people in this country, anyway. It's an unexamined habit to feel bad about slavery, so we're in the danger of forgetting the horror of it, the incredible nonsense and folly of it. So it gives us an utterly absurd scenario to shock us back into something like appropriate hatred of slavery. this is how I read it after listening to it many, many times. Every time that line comes around, every man is free to take care of his family. You're just like, you know, no. That's precisely what people were not allowed to do. And so this is a powerful song to me, although at first listening it can be very, very off-putting. A lot of Randy Newman songs are satirical. Art that is satirical usually exaggerates evil and vice in order to mock it in some way. So in satire, a writer will usually, very often say the precise opposite of what they really mean in order to startle us and in order to bring about some important truth we wouldn't see otherwise. One of the most, I think, brilliant examples of satire is the Screwtape Letters, in which Lewis takes on the voice of a demon, giving advice to a junior demon about how to mess with the human being and deceive them away from the Lord. Throughout the whole book, the Lord is referred to as the enemy. But really, Lewis is doing this to point out some very, very insightful things about our own self-deception. But also, it's satire. He's the end result is that he is mocking the devil, essentially, the folly of the devil. Flannery O'Connor's stories very often. Joe Morrell is famous for reading Flannery O'Connor's stories to our students, and he's done for many years. It's a wonderful part of what being at the Brie is here anyway. Having Flannery O'Connor read to you. disturbing, but wonderful. She was a Roman Catholic writer whose stories are very ambiguous and disturbing. But she thought of herself as painting with broad brushstrokes. She used that phrase because the culture had become blind to goodness and evil. So she says, to the deaf you speak loudly, to the blind you paint with broad brushstrokes. People don't recognize vice as vice anymore. So she's setting out, in a sense, to make evil ugly to us again. And that means she writes in these crazy, exaggerated, distorted pictures of people. Very intentionally, as a Christian, this is not just a random artistic choice she's making. This is, as a Christian, she's choosing to do this in order to make evil ugly. And this means that her stories are not pretty. They are not pretty, but they're powerful, and we can gain a lot from them if we take the time. So these kinds of stories and songs destabilize us, but I would say in a productive way. They challenge us in areas where comfort is not appropriate. It's not a good thing to be comfortable when we're talking about certain things, slavery included. Ambiguity also can be is a way of just being true to life. I was glad earlier Marty mentioned the passage out of Philippians 4 where Paul says, finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Interestingly, this passage is very often used as a critique of art that deals with disturbing subject matter. Right? Because aren't we supposed to be thinking about lovely things? Isn't there enough nastiness in the world already? And shouldn't Christians be people who bear a message of hope and joy? Yes, but never at the expense of the whole truth. And so I wonder, I haven't studied this passage in any depth, but the fact that Paul begins by saying whatever is true, this isn't just true as in one thing in a list of things we should be thinking about, but as a controlling idea over the whole list. You could check that with the commentary. I'm not sure that's true. But it seems to be whatever's true and then whatever else comes after that. Meaning, it's possible to focus on things that are lovely and ignore the true things that are terrible. And these Christian these things that are beautiful and admirable and lovely and pure and excellent, they're real, and we're supposed to reflect on them, but never in a way that's denying the reality of what is not lovely and what is not excellent and admirable, as if those things didn't exist. So he's not giving us an invitation to escapism in that list of things. I think this presents artists who are Christians with a difficult task. In their art, to not dwell on gratuitously nasty themes. A lot of art is accused of just rubbing your face in the grime of the world, you know, just shock value kind of art. That's an accusation that gets lobbed around a lot. Sometimes for good reason, but not always. We're not really invited as Christians to just gratuitously wallow in the nastiness of the world. But to point in some way to what is good and noble and admirable. But, and yet, to do so without denying the truth that everything we do takes place in a terribly broken reality. There is hope, but the world is filled with tragedies. And so I think this should be a tension that Christian artists should feel and should be thinking about, should be engaging with. The tension between bringing some vision of hope, maybe not explicit and in your face, but some plausible vision of hope without denying the reality of all the things that rob us of hope in the world. Sometimes it's only by being ambiguous that art can be faithful to this kind of tension, which is just part of life, I think. The art making, conceived of in Christian terms, I think, should be engaging the world in which we actually find ourselves, not some other simpler world or some world that's easier to deal with. We don't actually, it seems to me, we if we're artists who are Christians, we don't want to find ourselves playing the role of the false prophet in the Old Testament who tells the people nice things that they want to hear instead of the truth, right? The false prophets often just tell the king what he wants to hear. Absolutely, nothing you can do will fail. Go to battle, you're blessed. You know, not always true, right? Those are the false prophets who who are the ones that tell the king what he wants to hear. If we are artists, not that artists necessarily are always prophets, but to the extent to which we have a prophetic voice as artists and who are into our culture, we don't want to be false prophets, right? It's all another way of saying basically that Christians, whether we're artists or not, this applies to everybody, have a responsibility to acknowledge the real effects of the fall. The Bible teaches us that we're living in an in-between time in which the victory has been won through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, but the battle is still raging. And we're in the middle of it, we're in the thick of it. And theologians have called this the already and the not yet. Christians live in light of these two realities. What has happened already, which impacts what will inevitably come. Christ has won the victory. It will be fully realized someday. Those are the sort of bookends. But it's not yet fully realized, which means we're still in a battle. Does art made by Christians adequately reflect this complexity, which is real life? I think in real life, there is joy and beauty and gratitude and all kinds of wonderful things that we need to recognize and not downplay. But in real life, joy and sorrow are often side by side. Think of the ambiguities that we experience in life that are just part of living, the complexities, seeming contradictions, moral dilemmas, mixed emotions, competing goods, choosing the lesser of evils. I feel this in parenting every day. You're like, I made a bunch of decisions today. I'm not sure there was a right decision to be made, but I did something. how often we feel ambivalent about our choices. Was that the right thing to do? I'm not sure. Times when we don't feel or don't know how to feel or respond. Just two examples, sort of dramatic, but they're real. Just the reality of adoption. Someone who adopts a child into their family. We live in a world in which children are adopted, and that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Sometimes children who are in desperate need find good homes, right? That's something to rejoice about. We also live in a world in which adoption is necessary because so many homes are destroyed and broken and incapable of caring for small children. And so that's just part of what adoption is. It's a joy and it's a sadness. I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but this is a real example of someone I know from my church who was desperately ill, needed a kidney transplant. She finally got it, and we were rejoicing with her and her daughter, who's a friend of mine. But I found out later that the reason she received this kidney transplant is because this young man was murdered in the Midwest somewhere, and this kidney was made available. And so often you feel like there's a zero-sum gain here. Someone's joy is someone else's tragedy, right? But that's just what it is to live in the world, as it is now. So my point here is that whatever message of hope and joy we have will sound very hollow and fake if we do not also take into account the hardness of the world. We'll do ourselves a disservice as we try to communicate a Christian message of hope. If we pretend the hardness isn't real, right? It's just going to sound like fluff to people who actually know that the world is screwed up, whether they have a theology to explain it or not. So Christian hope is nothing if it does not speak meaningfully into the darkest places. It doesn't depend on things being nice. And I think that's really, again, a challenge to people making art and a challenge to us as we look at art. We already talked about this a little bit last night, but I think one of the things we need to do is reclaim the ambiguities that are in the Bible. It's not a foreign concept in Scripture, and particularly, we talked a little bit about this last night, the parables of Jesus, the questions he asked. Jesus is very sensitive to the fact that human beings are moved by their imaginations. When Jesus tells a parable to a crowd, he almost never explains what he means. He does in private to his disciples a couple times. But as Dick was saying last night, he uses very concrete pictures and stories and images, central images that appeal to the senses. Then he often says something like, "Let those who have ears hear." And this is sort of an invitation to engage imaginatively and enter into the story he just told. It's also an acknowledgement that some people will not bother, I think. To enter into Jesus' parables, we have to push on the door a little, or a lot. If we can't be bothered to push on the door, then maybe we don't have ears to hear. The Good Samaritan parable is a story with many layers to it. One of the problems with familiar stories is that they're familiar, that we don't think about them. They sort of go in one ear and out the other. But the more we reflect on what that might have sounded like in the ears of this person Jesus is talking to, the more we realize that it's quite an offensive story to this particular man, and has layers of meaning to peel back. It's not an easy thing to consume and move on. It would have bothered people too much. It's not just telling people how we should treat others. It's saying, you really hate your neighbor. And what do you do with the scenario in which that neighbor, in which you despise, behaves more righteously than you do? In which you're in need of his help and he gives it. See, this is a challenging story. The Good Samaritan, it's the Samaritan who's being good. It's not the Jew who's reaching out to a Samaritan. Like, so there's a reversal in the story that would have been an offense to the person, I think, who was hearing. The parable of the workers in the vineyard seems to make... This is the parable where the vineyard owner goes out and hires a bunch of different people at different times throughout the day. At the end of the day, there's guys who've worked all day long, and there's guys who've worked 1 hour, and he pays them all the same, sends them home. And everybody gets mad. Or the people that worked all day get mad. So why would Jesus tell a story like that? That the more we reflect on it, I think we realize, seems to be making the good news of the gospel offensive to nice, hardworking Christians. Why would he do that? Well, we wouldn't know. We wouldn't find out unless we actually entered into it and thought about it a bit and tried to maybe even place ourselves in the story and pay attention to the fact that I'm offended by that story. Who am I identifying with if I get offended by that story? I'm identifying with the person that's worked really hard and is righteous and is great. You know, why do I identify myself with that person? So, Jesus is demanding and provocative and at times ambiguous. His stories are begging for engagement, and we can be sure that many people in the crowd kept thinking about them for a long time afterwards. And that was the idea. The parables are obviously a powerful part of Jesus' teaching. This is him teaching people. But only if we make the effort to enter in with our imaginations. And only because he leaves room for us to enter in. He doesn't just tell us, you should like Samaritans. You should be kinder and not be so prejudiced, right? So, up until now, I've been sort of making a case for why ambiguity in art can be a good thing. But I think most of us know that there's been a lot of resistance to this idea. Maybe you may resist that idea. Both in our culture in general, but particularly within Christian circles, I think. So, what about this resistance to ambiguity? Christianity has not been associated in recent years with an openness to ambiguity in art. So I want to look at some of the reasons for this, or potential reasons for this. There's a woman who's a curator and very plugged into the art scene in Charlottesville, named Maureen Lovett, and I read an article by her once. She made an interesting distinction. Well, she said, there's two broad expectations of art that many Christians have, and these two expectations make them suspicious of ambiguity. The first expectation is that art should be useful, and the second is that art should be safe. And these are two ideas that are quite related, useful and safe, but I decided I'd just look at both of those and use her categories, which I found helpful. So art must be useful. There's a whole discussion in the philosophy of art over what use does art have, and is it okay to talk about art as having a use, and I'm not going to get into that at all. I really want to talk about what do Christians usually mean when they say art should be useful, which is a different kind of conversation. In Christian circles, art has often been deemed worthwhile only if it is useful for advancing the kingdom of God, and what is meant by this usually is that art must clearly demonstrate its usefulness for evangelism, or is connecting with people, to conveying the message of the gospel clearly and bringing people to Christ. If it's not shown to have some use toward that goal, then we're not sure we can justify it, its existence. This is a good desire. I'm not at all saying that we should not be concerned with conveying the message of the gospel. But I think the fact is Christians have not always been very perceptive as to what kinds of songs and images and poems and films are likely to be effective in turning people and people's hearts back to God. Ultimately, this gets into the discussion of the Lordship of Christ over all of life that we were talking about earlier in a sacred-secular kind of division. That's part of what's going on here. But ultimately, this has resulted in a very destructive restriction of what art made by Christians has to be. A restriction on what is appropriate subject matter, like H.H. was saying, you know, biblical subjects, pictures illustrating biblical stories, that's okay. But it also limits the tone we can take, what are the acceptable motivations behind what we're doing as artists, how should we speak about our art, how should we think about our audience. This notion of art being useful for evangelism puts restrictions on all of these quite heavily. So art that deals, like I said, art that deals specifically with biblical themes is good. Art that tells stories of people coming to faith and realizing the folly of secular thinking, those are good. Art portraying Christian victories, triumphs. Art that communicates the truth of the gospel with clarity, where the message is explicit and potential misunderstandings are preempted. This is good. We can see if these are the criteria we need to justify a work of art, ambiguity is terribly out of place. It's only going to undermine the sole purpose of the art, right? Evangelism is, one understanding of evangelism is it has to be absolutely straightforward communication, presenting the simple truth. It's not supposed to confuse people or leave them with questions. It's an open question, actually. Maybe it is supposed to leave people with questions, but I'm talking about a particular view of it. There are a number of problems with this, I think. Assumption that art must have evangelism as its real purpose. I'll just talk about three, but I'm sure there are more. There's an implicit assumption here that the role of art is to be didactic. Sorry. That is to teach or instruct. That's the purpose. When we say somebody is being didactic, we mean they are imparting knowledge to us. They're lecturing us. They're presenting a lesson of some kind to us, whether it's a moral lesson or something else. So maybe the artist is just a teacher who's using different tools. This is worth discussing. Is art supposed to be didactic? Is the primary role of an artist to present some sort of clear lesson and presumably get the audience to agree? That's implied. If that's what we mean by teach, I want to say probably no, that isn't what art is for. To just teach a very clear lesson to try to get your audience to agree with you. However, I think art can teach us, but in a very different way. Not simply by appealing to our intellect with a clear lesson, but because it makes contact with us at the level of our imaginations, it can actually help direct and even shape our desires over time. Certainly not on its own. It's not like art is the one solution to our problem with desire. But still, it can have a huge impact on us. It's through exposure to art that many of us experience the most intense longing we've ever had. I think that's true for me. I think particularly in music, these moments, experiences of intense longing, are very often prompted by listening to music. Longing, though, can be for good or ill, right? Depends what I'm longing for. What is the art that I'm most drawn to encouraging me to long for? What kinds of people or choices or ways of life does it present as appealing? In Christian terms, I think one of the roles of art is to help people to begin to long for the right things. And that's a very broad, open task. That's not any one thing. But you can't actually do this. You can't help people begin to long for the right things by reasoned arguments that tell them what they should long for. It's a wonderful quote by George MacDonald that Dick read last night. This is, I don't have the quote on the top of my head, but lectures about morality are worth nothing compared to a plausible picture of what goodness is in a story. So, you can best get at the moral imagination through stories and images that avoid being didactic, actually. There's a guy that we, in the past year or so, have been quoting to each other a lot at LaBrie, named James K.A. Smith, and he wrote a book called Imagining the Kingdom. He's written several books. I'm not sure it's his most recent, but a very helpful one is called You Are What You Love. I recommend it to everybody. But this is from his book Imagining the Kingdom. He's getting at this this whole idea. Much of our action is not the fruit of conscious deliberation. Instead, much of what we do grows out of our passional orientation to the world, affected by all the ways we have been primed to perceive the world. In short, our action emerges from how we imagine the world. What we do is driven by who we are, by the kind of person we have become. And that shaping of our character is, to a great extent, the effect of stories that have captivated us, that have sunk into our bones, the stories that picture what we think life is about, what constitutes the good life. We live into the stories we've absorbed. We become characters in the drama that has captivated us. Thus, much of our action is acting out a kind of script that has unconsciously captured our imaginations. And so he's really talking about mostly about what a human being is. You know, a human being is not just a computing machine. It's, we're creatures who desire and love and have longings and connect with story because of that. But this also, it says a lot about the power of art. He's not talking about art here, but what drives us is the stories we place ourselves in through our imaginations. This can be an inspiring thing, and it can be a word of caution, because how many of us are even conscious of the stories that are driving us right now? We would like to think that I'm driven by the story in the Bible, right? I'm driven by the biblical narrative that is revealed to me in the Bible. Is that always what's driving me? Is that the longing that is in me all the time when I'm not thinking about what I should be longing for? We are in a culture in which there are lots of competing stories, lots of competing things to long for. So, in any case, the didactic model of art, I think, is inadequate because art is not a second best way of communicating when lectures and arguments and essays and sermons fail. Art is not a second best way of communicating. Art is capable of reaching human beings on a level that these other things often cannot. It has its own unique and valid mode of communicating that accesses the world of our desires through our imaginations. So whatever art has to say, it says as art. If you're a painter, you should not think of yourself as writing an essay disguised as a painting. You should think of yourself as having something to say in paint, right? The expectation that art should be didactic, I think, has led many of us to view complex art as simply a problem to solve or a riddle to decode. So we come to something we don't understand. We're like, what's the secret? I want to crack it, as if in the way that we would crack a nut. We take away the message, which is what you want. You think of an almond. Have you ever cracked an almond that actually is in its shell? You crack the shell to get at the nut in the middle. And you throw the shell away, you jettison the shell because it's worthless, but you have the nut now. That's the way we often view the message in a work of art. I want to crack the nut, take away the message, and jettison the shell. In other words, the actual thing itself, the medium, whatever it is irrelevant. The message is what's important, what's being said. At the end of the day, we wish the piece had just explained itself to us a little better and saved us some time. Right? I confess I've felt this way. Do I have the energy to figure out what to engage with this right now? Tell me what you mean. but I don't have all these quotes at my fingertips, but there's a series of wonderful ways in which artists have really pushed back against that assumption. One of them was a poet, I forget whether it was Robert Frost or T.S. Eliot, or somebody said, you know, someone asked him, explain what this poem meant. And he says, well, if I could explain it, I wouldn't have had to write the poem. He said, you want me to say it worse? That was his response. So, no, actually, I wrote the poem on purpose the way it is. That's what I'm trying to say, as it is. If you ask me to explain it, I'm just going to say it worse. So that's good. It was a little, the other quote I was thinking about was a famous dancer who was asked, what did this mean? He's like, well, if I could tell you that, I wouldn't have danced it. That implies that the art itself carries me, has an authentic, valid way of communicating as art. There's a wonderful quote that a friend who knows a lot more about film than I do, he pointed me in the direction of this quote by the wonderful Russian filmmaker Tarkovsky, but he wrote a book called Sculpting in Time, and he kind of nails one of these ideas I'm trying to get at here. sorry for all the text-heavy screens here. Particularly on a lecture in art. I don't have enough illustrations. At least I know it. I'm sorry. The point is that it's not good bypassing the difficulties and bringing everything down to a simplistic level. Therefore, it is crucial that the film, rather than illustrating some idea, should follow life. The personalities of the characters and their psychological state. Its purpose must not be reduced to elaborating on the meaning of a conversation or an action. Its function is to startle us with the authenticity of the actions and the beauty and depth of the artistic images, not by obtrusive illustration of their meaning. As is so often the case, undue emphasis on ideas can only restrict the spectator's imagination, forming a kind of thought ceiling beyond which there yawns a vacuum. It doesn't safeguard the frontiers of thought. It simply makes it harder to penetrate into its depths. So there's a number of wonderful phrases to take away. Obtrusive illustration of their meaning. Here's what I mean by this. You know, let's have a dialogue in a film elaborate what I was trying to get at somehow in a very explicit way. He's saying, no, this actually creates a ceiling that prevents the audience from entering in a way that they need to engage with what you're saying. So this is just another way of saying art actually forfeits its power the more didactic it becomes. If art must justify itself by being useful for evangelism, I think there's another problem. I'm still in that section. And I think I'm just going to talk about this briefly, it's a pragmatic problem. If we concede, just for a moment, that this is the only use for art, the only justifiable use for art, we should be allowed to ask the question, does it work? Does art that has its only goal as evangelism actually end up being good evangelism? Very often not at all. I think art that is motivated solely by a desire to communicate the gospel usually fails as art and as evangelism. Now this is this can be contested. We can argue about that later. That's fine. But why? Why might this be the case? I think in part because the total lack of ambiguity in so much of what is called Christian art. I know that's a very loaded phrase, but what the artist wants you to believe is so painfully obvious that no real secular person comes within a mile of it, right? Speaking the simple truth is appropriate in some context. But in art, I think, in much of art, it does not actually welcome people in, but pushes them away. It's perceived as art that's meant for somebody else, or it's perceived as art that's intended to get them to change their minds about something. And then the result of what often ends up happening is that works that were justified for their evangelism potential end up becoming just devotional material for people who are already Christians. That ends up being the purpose. Art that encourages us. Art that reminds us that we're still right in a confusing and hostile world. That's how a lot of this functions. I have to confess, I have not seen this movie. I've seen the trailer several times, but the movie God Is Not Dead, There's another one now. But it seems to me, and my extremely limited viewing of the movie by the trailer, at least the movie that the trailer was trying to sell, right? I'll say that. Seems to be doing this, radically oversimplifying of issues in which the unbeliever is caricatured and easy to dismiss as an arrogant fool, basically. It's this professor that makes all of his philosophy 101 students write on a piece of paper the first day of class, "God is dead. Now we can have a conversation." And the one Christian student says, "You know what, I'm a Christian." And then it's this story about him triumphing over his professor. You know, I don't know, I don't want to step on toes if anybody, maybe there's helpful things in the film. I haven't seen it. So I need to watch what I say, obviously. But I fear that that's the case, because I haven't spoken to any non-Christians that have taken any interest in this film. It's all people that felt really sort of bolstered up in their faith by it. In a way that, like I said earlier, is about feeling right in a confusing and hostile world. Reminds us that we're right. That is not necessarily a bad thing, but let's be honest about what's happening there. This didn't actually connect with anybody that wasn't a Christian, I don't think. Moving along, my third sort of observation about this idea about art being useful only for evangelism. I think the third one is really a theological problem. The last one was a pragmatic one. This is a theological one. To treat art as only a means to present Christ to the world actually excludes Christ from the entire process of making art. And I need to justify that statement. The question is, to me, the question is, do we better honor Christ as Lord by treating art as a subordinate vehicle for the Christian message, which is the thing that's important, an irrelevant husk, you know, for the precious kernel inside, that image of the nut, you know, is the art itself just the shell, and the gospel is the message, right? Is that the image? Do we honor Christ better by approaching art that way, or do we better honor him by making the best art we can, trusting that he cares about excellence in every step of the creative process, so that Christ is in the making and in the medium, not just in the message? I think the latter, obviously. I'm sort of, you probably guessed. Option two is my favorite. As Christians who make art, we should not treat our theology as something external to the art and subordinate the art as a means to an end, a means to that higher end. Our theology should be how we make art, the sort of the air we breathe while creating. And I think this is a much deeper and more robust understanding of Christ as Lord. Christ is allowed into the making itself. And again, Sarah beat me to the punch this morning by quoting Dorothy Sayers at length. But now, I'm going to, well, different quotes. So she said a lot of great things. Dorothy Sayers, this is in her introduction to a series of plays she wrote about the life of Christ. It's called The Man Born to Be King. And keep in mind that this is what she's saying about her attempt to write drama based on the accounts of the Gospels. That's her source material for what she's doing. So surely, in this case, her motivation must be to bring people to Christ, right? And she's writing a play about Jesus, 12 plays. But even here, she says, no, that wasn't my purpose. So I apologize for the length of this quote, but there's so many good things in it, and I just decided to quote it in full. In writing a play on this particular subject, the dramatist must begin by ridding himself of all edificatory, attempts to edify, terrible words there, and theological intentions. He must set out not to instruct, but to show forth. Not to point a moral, but to tell a story. Not to produce a divinity lesson with illustrations and dialogue. This is Tarkovsky's idea, just expounding on your meaning. But to write a good piece of theater. It was assumed by many pious persons who approved the project that my object in writing The Man Born to Be King was to do good. But that was in fact not my object at all, though it was quite properly the object of those who commissioned the plays in the first place. Fine, fair enough. My object was to tell that story to the best of my ability, within the medium at my disposal. In short, to make as good a work of art as I could. For a work of art that is not good and true in art is not good or true in any other respect, and is useless for any purpose whatsoever, even for edification, because it is a lie, and the devil is the father of all such. As drama, these plays stand or fall. The idea that religious plays are not to be judged by the proper standard of drama derives from a narrow and lopsided theology, which will not allow that all truth, including the artist's truth, is in Christ, but persists in excluding the Lord of truth from his own dominions. What this actually means is that the theology, the dogma, must be taken by the writer as part of the material with which he works, and not as an exterior end towards which his work is directed. Accordingly, it is the business of the dramatist not to subordinate the drama to the theology, but to approach the job of truth-telling from his own end, and trust the theology to emerge undistorted from the dramatic presentation of the story. That's Dorothy Sayers from Man Born to be King, her introduction, talking about the task of writing plays based on the life of Christ. So, Sayers is not setting out to evangelize people through her art, even through a play which is about Jesus. She's trying to tell a good story, and insofar as she does this, she's confident that the theology will speak. Because, as she says, her theology is part of the material with which she works. And if we can say this about plays about the life of Christ, how much more can we say it about art that is not directly religious in subject matter? For an artist who is a Christian, I think evangelism should not be the goal of our art. Our job is rather to welcome Christ into the art making, where he can be Lord over every aspect of it from start to finish. So songwriting for me is what I've spent the most time sort of butting my head against. And I think this has been a real challenge to me, to actually resist maybe proclaiming my theology as clearly as I want to, or feel like doing in any given moment, while still trying to make some picture of hope a plausible thing. On the positive side, to truly honor Christ as Lord of art is to step into a very spacious place, actually, because Jesus Christ cares about every aspect of human existence and experience. And we can engage with all kinds of different things without dishonoring him in any way. So this is not a restriction. This is a incredible freedom. Moreover, I think if we're freed from the expectation that we are just supposed to evangelize through our art, ambiguity is on the table again. It's something that's a potential thing we can use as artists, an actual mode of communicating. So that was all about art being useful. What about art being safe? That's another kind of concept that that I think many of us struggle with. And I want to be very clear, this is not just a Christian problem. I'm not dumping on Christians for being dumb about art. This is a culture-wide problem. We are part of a society which spends a vast amount of time and money and energy to entertain itself and distract itself from hard realities. Pop culture entertainment is a balance of providing excitement while basically being safe. Much of what we would call mainstream commercial art, the movies, pop music, basically tells people what they want to hear, reinforcing what they believe. And this is entertainment. This is what the entertainment business is often about. Not always, but there's nothing wrong with being entertained. Sometimes we need that. But is that all art needs to be? Something easily consumable, something very safe, something that does not challenge us very much. It's obvious what I'm getting at. Ambiguity actually is something that makes us feel unsafe, right? We feel there's a danger in not understanding a piece right away. And this might be the case particularly for people who've grown up in Christian homes which are more legalistic, I guess you could say, where the Christian faith has been reduced to a list of things we need to reject. Right? things that are not okay to engage with, if our faith is sort of reduced to that list of things that we're not supposed to do or enjoy, that will contribute to this. How often do we feel we need to understand a film or a poem or a painting completely so that we can form an opinion about it as quickly as possible, so that we can know whether it's okay to enjoy it? This is, I don't know whether this is that. Okay. I don't know if it's just something I made up. Okay. We feel we need an answer to the question, should I be liking this right now? But we can't unless we first know exactly what's going on and can evaluate it. Maybe I should not be enjoying this, but how would I know? Unless I can explain what's going on perfectly. Unless I know exactly what every image signifies in this film. Unless I know whether or not I agree with the worldview of the artist. You know, how do I know whether I should enjoy this? Strange and open-ended and enigmatic stories and songs are a threat to this mindset, right? They leave us with questions that prevent us from forming an immediate opinion. That's what we want to do. We have to sit with those kinds of stories and maybe go away and reflect on them and come back. How many of you can, after watching a substantially challenging film, have something to say about it right away for the first time you viewed it? And sometimes we expect people to watch films here at Libri and then have a discussion right afterwards, and sometimes I feel it's completely unfair because I usually have nothing to say about a film until later, or maybe after the second or third viewing. But that's okay, is what I'm trying to say. Flannery O'Connor makes a fascinating point about this kind of thing in her book Mystery and Manners. I'm going to read this quote that has always delighted me, although I'm not sure whether it delights everybody, but this is in a book of essays just kind of talking about the craft of writing fiction. Last fall I received a letter from a student who said she would be graciously appreciative if I would tell her just what enlightenment I expected her to get from each of my stories. I suspect she had a paper to write. I wrote her back to forget about the enlightenment and just try to enjoy them. I knew that was the most unsatisfactory answer I could have given, because of course she didn't want to enjoy them. She just wanted to figure them out. In most English classes, the short story has become a kind of literary specimen to be dissected. Every time a story of mine appears in a freshman anthology, I have a vision of it with its little organs laid open like a frog in a bottle. I realize that a certain amount of this, what is the significance, has to go on, but I think something has gone wrong in the process when, for so many students, the story becomes simply a problem to be solved, something which you evaporate to get instant enlightenment. This is what I'm getting at here. A story really isn't any good unless it successfully resists paraphrase, unless it hangs on and expands in the mind. Properly, you analyze to enjoy. But it's equally true that to analyze with any discrimination, you have to have enjoyed already. And I think that the best reason to hear a story read is that it should stimulate that primary enjoyment. This is encouraging to me because I don't understand all of Flannery O'Connor's stories, but I find myself enjoying them a lot. Yet, I don't fully get what's going on. But she's saying, actually, you know what? You have to enjoy it in order to understand it. And this is okay. It's okay not to have an opinion about everything we see right when we first see it. I think most excellent art is deep and rich enough to actually demand many, many viewings. So, I'm going to skip a bit to get closer to the end here because we're running out of time. But I think one of the examples of it being enamored with safety in art is sentimentality, and we already talked about Thomas Kincaid briefly in the discussion this morning. But I'm conscious that he's kind of an easy target. I don't want to just beat Thomas Kincaid up because it's easy. Although I do want to mention him because he's put himself out there very intentionally as what I'm doing as a Christian, and this is why I'm doing it. And it has said some things that I think we can push back on a bit. he's really been, sort of, for many people, he's been the embodiment of everything that's cheesy and mass-produced and sentimental. He's been called a merchandise monger, masquerading as an artist. This is how he's actually described his own work. I'm just going to give you something to look at. Okay. This is not him talking, but this is someone talking about him. So this is a sort of a reviewer or whatever. Thomas Kincaid, the celebrated painter of light, is one of the most widely collected and beloved artists of our day. Each year, millions of people are drawn to the luminous light and tranquil mood of Kincaid's paintings and include his creations in their lives through prints, books, and other fine collectibles. An inspired idealist, Thomas Kincaid believes art has the power to touch people's hearts and change their lives. Kincaid's artwork is an outgrowth of his deep faith in God, which he believes is to be the foundation of his work. In my paintings, I try to create worlds of tranquility, joy, and beauty. Thomas Kincaid's paintings have become visions of hope and comfort, a welcome haven from the pressures of modern life. The light-infused quality in his work may account for Thomas Kincaid's enormous popularity as an internationally published artist. Virtually every subject he puts his hand to, whether cottage or countryside, small-town America or bustling city, seems infused with a radiant quality. He is capable of capturing a special moment on canvas and rendering it timeless by the warm light of nostalgic memory. Rather than embrace the intellectual isolation of the artist, Thomas Kincaid makes each of his works an intimate statement that resonates in the personal lives of his viewers. I share something in common with Norman Rockwell, and for that matter, with Walt Disney, Kincaid says, in that I really like to make people happy. Thomas Kincaid's oil paintings and reproductions communicate deeply with viewers, providing a warm nostalgia in a complex and often stressful world. I try to create paintings that are a window for the imagination. If people look at my work and are reminded of the way things once were, or perhaps the way they could be, then I've done my job. In another place, he's quoted as saying specifically, my job as an artist is to portray a picture of the world without the fall. He's said that specifically. That's a long extended quote. But you think of all the images of safety, all the ways in which safety were referred to in what he was saying. Comfort, haven, escape, nostalgia, warmth, glow, those are all as a source of safety and retreat from a stressful and complex world. He actively avoids difficult subject matter altogether and turns rather to nostalgia for the past, which was supposedly easier and less complex. But actually, nostalgia almost never refers to the past that actually was. It's sort of a way of romanticizing or rose-tinting the past. And Kincaid kind of embodies this. Nothing in our past ever looked like that. So he's talking about nostalgia for the past, but that wasn't how the past was either. So to enjoy a Kincaid painting, I think you have to agree with the rules of his game, which are it's okay to avoid facing real brokenness in the world, and to retreat into a world that never was and probably never will be. This is basically sentimentality. It's refusing to acknowledge the reality of evil and the grip that it has in the world. And this is actually not the Christian hope. This is not what the Bible offers as a hope, to pretend that reality is different than it is. Actually, Christian hope is founded on God's promises, which are true and trustworthy despite whatever confusion and misery we happen to be experiencing now. It's in the despite that Christian hope is to be found. There is hope even now, even here, in the midst of this chaos. And so this is a totally different thing. Christian hope is a totally different thing from optimism, which just kind of expects the best to happen, or sentimentality, which pretends evil doesn't exist. That's just one of the ways in which I think we need to push back on art as primarily being about safety. Sentimentality or the perception of being sentimental is one of the reasons why so many people are turned off by the church. That's just something we need to be aware of as we think about apologetics. to systematically avoid addressing the brokenness in the real world is to willingly relinquish any voice we might have to speak into the world that's actually broken, because most people know that's the case. So I'm just going to conclude with a couple of... I've basically been trying to encourage both people who make art that it's okay to explore ways of being ambiguous. And I also want to encourage people who appreciate art that it's okay to take the time and effort to engage with things we don't immediately understand. The word that has come to mind for me again and again preparing for this is trust. And for Christians, we're supposed to trust God in every circumstance. Could our interactions with art be another area of life, like any other area of life, in which we need to relinquish some of our control and trust God? So, as an audience, if we're part of an audience, if we're readers of literature or theater or moviegoers, members of the local museum, whatever it is, can we trust that God is Lord, even in a room filled with incomprehensible installation pieces? Is God Lord there? Can I trust Him that I might actually be stretched in good ways as I engage with work that I don't understand at first? Can we trust Him that there is something worth engaging with, even when we know the artist shares nothing of our worldview, but nonetheless is made in God's image? Can I trust, would have the humility, really, to maybe be open to learning something from somebody who's not a Christian? Can we trust His goodness and power to allow our minds to dwell on the tensions of real life, the reality of the fall? Can we trust our own freedom under God when we find ourselves enjoying things that we don't yet understand? Is there freedom to do that or not? And if we're artists, if we're painters or composers or dramatists, whatever, filmmakers, can we trust God to use us even as we produce open-ended and ambiguous work? Can he use that? Any artist makes something and then releases it, and they no longer, you know, theoretically people will be looking at it or listening to it, and they're not able to speak to the artist, so you're releasing it. Do we trust God to do something with what we've created? Can we trust our identity in Christ, which is secure, even as we explore in our art things we don't understand yet? So much of art is about, a lot of artists talk about discerning what they're trying to say as they make the art. It's not as if they have an idea and they just go and execute it. That's been the case for me, at least. And then lastly, can we trust Him with our work as we release it to a public, knowing that it might be misunderstood? That's an aspect of trust, too. This might be misunderstood, or someone might look at it, not get it, and decide not to engage at all. That's a possibility. But another whole sphere of trust for the Christian life. That's where I'm going to end. I'm sorry I've gone a little bit late, but we're going to have, I guess, a brief break and then come back for a discussion. Yeah, how many, like, 10-minute break? Or?
10 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe just have it and come back.
Yep.
I want to make sure there's time for discussion. So, come on back.